Success or failure can be an elusive thing to pin down in advance. It might seem obvious, but nonetheless, it's true. Sometimes success seems predetermined, like a sports team that many will believe have a lock on a championship, or sometimes failure can seem equally predetermined. In most cases, however, success is more a matter of determination and perseverance than luck or skill. We'll elaborate on that thought as we go through here today, but some of the most successful Christians, if I can use that expression, are those who have stayed the course rather than those who seem destined to succeed. Many times there can be success in what others would deem failure, and as I set the stage today, let me give you an example to illustrate this point. There was once a man who seemed destined for success in God's work. He had the adoration of his peers. He seemed to have the qualifications, he had the good looks, he had the support of all of those around him for the work that he needed to do. He was even endorsed for this position by God. He was anointed and instructed in God's way. He was given wealth, he was given power and position. But in spite of all of that, he failed. He didn't listen to the instruction of the other spiritual leaders. He didn't listen to the instruction from God. He bowed to the pressure of other people, and he began to see his enemies in those who would have supported him. By way of contrast, there was another man in a similar position, but this man was the last to be considered for this job. He didn't have the looks or the universal support of his peers. He was at times a violent man, at times a man at even odds with God's law, and yet at times a man of great repentance and humility. The first man was King Saul. The second man was King David. Both had great failures in their lives, key areas. Yet David is considered a success because of how he handled those failures. Success as a Christian is not defined quite the same way as the world does, as we'll ponder this today. Success involves overcoming obstacles, staying focused, and putting into practice the actions and the goals necessary to succeed. This also means staying with a goal even when the going gets tough. And some of the great examples of success are those people who refuse to quit, who overcame great obstacles. And that's perhaps the primary difference between Saul and David. Saul gave up when he failed. He tried to find a way beside what God had told him to do. By way of comparison, David took the hits and he repented, and he sought to live God's way of life more fully. Sometimes we are limited in our success by our own self-imposed restrictions. Sometimes the criticism of others can limit us. Sometimes, honestly, we simply give up. Success is more of an option, obviously, when we don't embrace those viewpoints. So are we succeeding as a Christian? How is our determination, our perseverance, our willingness to sacrifice for our calling going? Are we succeeding in our calling through our failures? Today I'm going to talk about success, true success and failure that it sometimes takes to get there. And so the title today is simply Success in Failure. And putting together this sermon, I came across a number of interesting quotes and stories concerning people or things that were expected to fail, that no one at the time expected to come to anything. The common thread in all of them is the willingness to buck conventional wisdom and to persevere in their vision until they succeeded. And the first example I'll give you is Thomas Edison. Very familiar with him. He, of course, invented the light bulb, amongst many other things, but the light bulb is probably his most famous or notable invention. It has been said, and the number varies, but it's been said that he tried over 2,000 different experiments before he got the light bulb to work. Various compositions in terms of how the bulb was built, designed, different materials used for different aspects of the bulb. But 2,000 times he tried. And after he succeeded and it was shown that this was something viable and repeatable that could be used to the benefit of many, a young reporter once asked him what it was like to fail so many times. And it said that Edison replied, "I never failed once. I invented the light bulb. It just happened to be a 2,000-step process." Let's go to the verse there on the screen, Genesis chapter 31, and let's look at a biblical example of someone who had to persevere, and I think God especially wanted to see persevere to know if he could use this man. The story here is of Jacob, and as he worked with his father-in-law, Laban. This, of course, was also 20 years after the way he obtained the birthright from his father and alienated his brother Esau. And so in Genesis 31 and verse 36, we pick up the story here then, because Laban had run after Jacob and his wives, Laban's daughters, after they had left. Jacob was unwilling, if you will, an unwilling accomplice to something that his wife had done in stealing from her father. But nonetheless, Jacob is angry here, and we see his point, if you will, of no longer wanting to be a part of what Laban had done to him. And so it says, Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban, and Jacob answered and said to him, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? And although you have searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it therefore before my brethren and your brethren, that they may be judged between us both." And so now he really gets into it, verse 38. "These 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was, in the day that drought consumed me, and frost by night, and the sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your household 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock. You have changed my wages 10 times. Not many people would put up with that. Not many people would have followed through. Verse 42, though, it shows here what part of the vision that he understood. He said, "Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Jacob, had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." And so then let's move down to verse 20 of chapter 32. Breaking in, he says, "Behold, your servant Jacob is behind us." This is as he approaches now his brother Esau. And as I mentioned, it had been 20 years since he'd seen him. And the last parting was not very good, was it? The relationship had been broken. And he wasn't sure how Esau was going to receive him. He says, "For I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face, and perhaps he will accept me." And so he sent his family, he sent his servants, he sent his flocks in front of him to approach Esau with these gifts in these successive waves, hoping to sort of mollify his anger if it was there. And so verse 23, he took them. This is his, verse 21, "The present went over before him, but he himself lodged that night in the camp. And he arose that night, took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons, crossed over the ford of Jabbok, and he sent them over the brook, over what he had. And then Jacob was left alone." And so now this very interesting interchange happens between, as it says, a man. This is an angel of God, a representative. And it says, "A man wrestled with him until the breaking of day." We're not introduced to how this happened, but Jacob seemed to understand something here. A man who did not start out life being on the up and up, did he? He was deceptive on many levels at many times. And so God is here proving him. I believe he used those 20 years with Laban to prove him, to see what it was like to be on the receiving end of that time and time and time again. But would he persevere and become the person that God wanted him to be? So these two individuals wrestled. And it seems that Jacob knew that this was important. And it says, "As he did not prevail," this is the angel, "did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, and the socket of the hip was out of joint." And you don't just touch a hip and put it out of socket. He wrenched it out. Very painful. And so then The angel says, let me go, for the day breaks. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He saw, again, something in this exercise, if you will, this situation. And so then the angel says, what is your name? And he says, Jacob. And he says, your name will no longer be called Jacob, which means heel catcher, a deceiver. But rather, he says, it will be called Israel. For you have struggled with God and men, and you have prevailed. He succeeded in a way that he had not before. God saw, maybe for the first time, that he was not going to do it deceptively, that he was going to see it through no matter what. And so then it says he blessed him. Many times, there can be success in what others would deem failure. But Jacob succeeded here with effort, didn't he? It wasn't just a matter of God dropping it in his lap, but Jacob needed determination. He needed to not fail in this, to not give up. There's an interesting quote from Napoleon Hill. Napoleon Hill was probably one of the forerunners, if you will, of what we now call a self-help author. He promoted a lot of really interesting thoughts. We'll see more of them as we progress through the sermon. But this quote I found very interesting. Effort only fully releases its reward after a person refuses to quit. Oftentimes in the culture around us especially, we see people who succeed in whatever endeavor. And it can be very easy to look at that and think that it's an overnight sensation. You've never heard of this person before and suddenly they burst on the scene in whatever form. And what we don't oftentimes see is the years, if not decades, that they spent practicing over and over and over again, preparing time and time again to be where they ended up being. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 9:10 as it validates this perception that Mr. Hill had. A very famous verse, Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. To pursue this calling that you and I have now with everything that we have, whatever the obstacles, whatever the difficulties, whatever the challenges, because, as it says, there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Once we're dead, the line is finished, isn't it? Are we crushed when we fail? Too many people are, and too many people then simply quit trying. But how many times do we need to pick ourselves up? The simple answer is every time. How many years does it take for us to succeed in some aspect of our calling? However many years it takes. For Jacob, it took 20 years. Maybe it takes 5 years or 10 years or 20 years for someone to overcome, to learn from their failure and to grow into the son of God or the daughter of God that he wants them to be. In that regard, then, what does the time matter? To consider another illustration from Scripture. Oh, what's happening there? Let's back up a little bit. We have the example of Ruth and Boaz. And as I'm going through that, let's turn to Hebrews 12. We're all familiar with this story. Ruth was not an Israelite. She was a Moabitess. Cousins, but nonetheless, not an Israelite. The Moabite gods were not the Israelite gods. Their culture was different. Everything was different. She had married the son of what should have been a leader within the nation of Israel. And that family left Israel when there was a famine. When the times got hard, when the challenges were presented, they did not step up. They left. In the course of time, the father died, the two sons died, and now it's just Naomi and the two daughters-in-law. And the one daughter-in-law goes back to her family, and Naomi, to some degree, encouraged Ruth to go back to hers, and Ruth says, no, I don't want to do that. I want the God of your nation. I want what you have. But she had a number of trials, didn't she? It was not an easy walk. She was a foreigner. She had to work hard for the food. It wasn't just handed to her. I'm sure there was a lot of whispers and conversations, derogatory things against her. But in Hebrews 12, verse 1, we read this. After the writer explains many of these stories of faith in chapter 11, we'll come back to that a little bit here. But he says, therefore, in light of those examples, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. And that's one of the really great things about how God has recorded the Bible for us. We have the examples of these people and their ordinary lives in so many ways. And he doesn't sugarcoat it. We see their ups and their downs. We see what they struggled with, and we see where they succeeded. And so Paul here writes, and he says, look, because of this, we have a great cloud of witnesses. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. This calling is not a sprint. It is a marathon. God has called us for the long haul here. And if we fail on a particular moment or day, we have time to make the best of that. To move on, let's look at the next quote here. I'll explain who Simon Newcomb is here in a moment. But he said this now infamous quote, if you will, or famous, depending on your perspective. Flight by machines heavier than air is unpractical and insignificant, if not utterly impossible. Simon Newcomb was not just some guy on the street, didn't know any better. He was a famous, at that time, very famous astronomer and applied mathematician in the late 1800s. After he made this statement, actually, it was only 18 months later that the Wright brothers made their successful attempt at Kitty Hawk in North Carolina. The Wright brothers didn't let the critics dissuade them because Mr. Newcomb wasn't the only one saying these sort of things. Many times there can be success in what others would deem failure. There's another famous example of the Beatles. As they began to become popular, they gained some notoriety in England, and they wanted to come across the pond and make their mark here in America. And one of the executives at Decca Records is recorded as having said here, "We don't like their sound." They didn't sign them up. Groups of guitars are on their way out. So in 1962, they turned them down. Sometimes failure seems impossible because of arrogance. There's no way I can't be wrong. And this executive probably had that. I know the music business. I've heard countless number of acts. But the Beatles didn't let the refusal of this major U.S. record label change their plans for success in America. They went on to great fame not long after that, appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show and just rocketing up the charts after that. And they had a successful run of a lot of years after that. To their credit, though, Decca did realize their error. After seeing the success of the Beatles, they went on to sign another new group named the Rolling Stones and many other successful rock bands. But Satan would like nothing more than to see you and me fail and give up on our calling. How many people started out at the same time you did when God called you, that are no longer a part of this walk? I was baptized with three other individuals. Not one of them attended Church of God anymore. I've seen that happen too many times over the years in the church. I've seen members who have been members for perhaps decades, maybe even someone in a position of a short authority. Maybe at times someone has the thought that surely I couldn't fail. I've been doing this for 30, 40 years or more. Satan couldn't hit me from this distance. I still remember a pastor we had when I was a boy in Cincinnati. On a number of occasions, he would make various comments. One comment he made was that he would rather be dead than not have God's Holy Spirit. I understand that sentiment. Other times he would make a comment that he would go crazy if he didn't have God's Spirit. Maybe he believed that by saying those things it would make it more real in his life, that it wouldn't happen, reinforce his desire for it not to happen. But sadly, a few years later, after making those types of comments, he did leave the church. He quit the ministry. He was no longer a member of the body. And the interesting thing that I observed even as a young boy was that he neither died nor went crazy. He simply went back into the world. Next illustration I want to show you is from a general, John Sedgwick. He was a general during the Civil War. He made this quote, "They couldn't shoot an elephant at this distance." If you know your Civil War history, those are the last words he spoke, because they indeed did hit an elephant from that distance, but it was him. He thought, while looking over a parapet at enemy lines, that there's no way anyone could fire that distance. But these enemy lines at the Battle of Spotsylvania in 1864 showed him differently. The arrogance of "I could not fail" or "I would not be wrong" cost him his life. Let's look next at 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, we find a warning for us. Paul writes, "Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall." While we have a goal in mind, while we have a desire to see God's hope fulfilled in each and every one of us, we could never become so arrogant as to think that it doesn't matter how we approach that. To continue in verse 13, he says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as common to men, but God is faithful and will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able." But see, there's the disconnect for us, isn't it? Because our idea of what that bar is much lower than what God knows it is. And so he allows trials. He allows difficulties in life. He allows circumstances to come up so that we see that we can do more. Because if the bar was as low as we wanted it to be, what would we learn? How much would we grow? But notice, he says, "But with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it." What's the old expression? When you find yourself in hell, keep walking. Don't stop. God is there beside us, and we'll come back to that point as well. The next illustration is from an Ernest Rutherford, and he said this, "The energy produced by the breaking down of the atom is a very poor kind of thing. Anyone who expects a source of power from the transformation of these atoms is talking moonshine." Now, who was Ernest Rutherford? He lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He was a very well-known and respected British physicist and was actually one of the very first individuals to ever split an atom. He's known as the father of nuclear physics. And yet, even with his knowledge, his experience, and all that he had done in that field, he did not see the value of what it could do. Not many years after he made that statement, the atom bomb was developed and used, a weapon of amazingly destructive power. A few decades later, that same atomic energy was harnessed for the source of generating electrical power. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 1. The challenge that you and I have in the calling that God has given us is that, much like many of the examples I've shared with you to this point, what we are doing seems foolish to the world. They don't see the value of what God is showing us and having us do. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 21, Paul writes this, "For since in the wisdom of God the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe." What you and I practice can seem very silly. We set aside a whole day of the week, a day when we could be shopping or we could be running errands or we could be doing whatever else in life, but we don't do anything except come before God to worship and honor him and study his word. We have the holy days. We have aspects of what's called the food laws and tithing and many other points of doctrine that so many look at and they say, you don't have to do that. It's not necessary. Why are you going through all of that? It seems foolish to them. But God said through that foolishness, he preached a message to save those who believe. Is that your vision? This is the success we're talking about. The success of becoming part of God's family. To continue in verse 25, he says, because the foolishness of God is wiser than man. Doesn't matter if it looks foolish to the world. It looks foolish because they don't understand it. Any more than Ernest Rutherford understood or appreciated what splitting of that atom would do. No more than John Sedgwick, as a general, should have known the likelihood that somebody could make that shot. No matter whether Decca Records thought the Beatles were good or not, to not see the potential and the markability of what they were doing. God, even if we might accept their wording, if you will, that it's foolishness, it says that foolishness is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Another example is that of Albert Einstein. It was said that at age 10, this is a schoolmaster's quote in Munich that was made about him, said to Albert Einstein at age 10, you will never amount to much. There have probably, unfortunately, been countless students that have heard similar things. And yet we know in hindsight that Mr. Einstein did indeed amount to a fair amount, didn't he? Although you have to appreciate where this schoolmaster was coming from to a degree, because Einstein was a very poor math student. Even later in life, he had to have others check his math because he was more focused on the concepts and the principles and working out the problem. He was an unimpressive student in general, but he still had a vision. And as a young man, he took a job in the Austria Patent Office. A job that was very boring, but afforded him a great amount of time to sit and think. And it was during that time, when he worked in the patent office, that he formulated what is now known as the theory of relativity. How many times has Satan whispered this same thought in your ear? You will never amount to much. The key to our success as a Christian is that we're not dependent solely on our own effort. And in fact, one of the really interesting things of those individuals who have succeeded, oftentimes they have the same thing. They have someone who believes in them. Let's look at that point in Philippians 4 and verse 13. Philippians 4 and verse 13, Paul writes here, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Paul knew that it wasn't him saying I can do all things. He knew that he could do all things with God beside him. All things with God working in him. All things with God strengthening him. So he had somebody helping him. Somebody that understood his vision, somebody that appreciated where he started and what it was going to take for him to get to where God wanted him to be. Do we believe this verse? Can you personalize this? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. A more recent example for all of us here is this quote here. The concept is interesting and well-formed, but in order to earn better than a C, the idea must be feasible. This was said by a Yale management professor commenting on a paper proposing overnight delivery service by Fred Smith. Fred Smith didn't listen to his management professor, decided to implement his idea, and went on to great success as the founder and CEO of what is now called FedEx. A service that probably every one of us use on a regular basis now. He was proposing something someone had never done before, that I could deliver something overnight, didn't matter what city you lived in. And he did this through what was called now the hub transportation idea. He picked Memphis as a relatively central area of the country, that no matter where you sent a package from, let's just say Milwaukee, Overnight, it would go to Memphis. It would be sorted with thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of other packages, put on a plane to whatever destination. Say we wanted to send it to Cincinnati. And it would be there by 10 o'clock the next morning. He revolutionized this whole delivery field, if you will. This Yale professor made a statement out of ignorance. And it's easy for many to think, if no one has succeeded in something like this, no one ever will succeed in something like this. It's not uncommon as well for people to criticize success or an endeavor they've never even thought about before. Why would you do that? That'll never work. Maybe you've had people even say that about the calling God has given you. Why would you do that? The next example is a little more lengthy that I want to cover. And this lady's name is Florence Chadwick. May not have known her or heard of her recently, but she was very well known in the late 1940s and early 1950s. We can see through her example and many others that we could probably call up on our own that failure once does not necessarily mean failure forever. The key is to learn from our failures and then persist in achieving success. We would not have the light bulb as we understand it today. Maybe somebody else would have invented it if Edison had not persisted. Florence Chadwick, though, was the first woman to swim the English Channel both directions, a distance of more than 24 miles. Having accomplished that, she set herself another goal, and this was a challenging one. She decided that she would become the first woman to swim what is called the Catalina Channel. This is the water between Catalina Island and the California coast, a distance of 21 miles, not as wide as the English Channel, but what was challenging about this is that those currents are much different, much stronger. But this is also an area, a body of water that tends to be very cold, and because of the difference in the water temperature and the air temperature, is often very foggy on a regular basis. But in 1952, at age 32, she set out to achieve this goal in a sea that was almost frozen and wrapped in a dense blanket of fog. She got into the frigid water. She struggled on, swimming hour after hour after hour, encouraged by her mother and a trainer following in a boat. They couldn't be in front of her. That would be leading. You could set the pace, if you will. So they had to be behind her, following her pace. And as I said, she did this for hour after hour, but unable to see anything ahead of her because of all this fog, she got tired and she pulled out. And it was only after they got her into the boat that they told her that they were only half a mile from the coast. Because she lost sight of her goal, she pulled up short. As disappointed as she was to have quit, being so close, it gave her extra determination that she was going to succeed. She would not give up on her goal. She set out 2 months later from Catalina in the same type of dense fog, the same cold water. But this time, she was not going to pull out. With extreme determination, she swam hour after hour after hour to get to the California coast and became not only the first woman to ever swim the Catalina Channel, she beat the men's record by 2 hours. Many times there can be success in determining not to fail again. We felt that once. We went through it once. We're not going to do it again. Let's go back to Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, this time in chapter 16. 1 Corinthians 16 and in verse 13. We have this admonition from Paul. He says, "Watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. Don't let a critic tell you it can't be done. Don't get tired, weary with well-doing and pull out. Don't let your courage waver." We have a similar example in Ezekiel 22 there, where Ezekiel records for us that God, as it says there, sought a man to stand in the gap. It's a lonely vigil to be the one standing in the gap, setting the example, being the trailblazer, if you will, the pioneer. But in the Hebrew there in Ezekiel 22:30, it's talking about someone who would rise to a need, to endure, to establish, to remain. This is our calling. In my introduction, I stated that success involves overcoming obstacles, staying focused, and putting into practice the actions and goals necessary to succeed. That's a general description of what success is. And in the world around us, this is true if you want to be successful as a music group, or if you have a vision of a new scientific achievement, or you're an athlete seeking to set a record, or if you simply want to turn the business world on its head. But it's really no different than anything we would do in our Christian calling. Failure is simply missing the mark and not continuing. Success involves taking as many steps as necessary in order to achieve what God would have us obtain. We fail, we get up, we see what we did wrong, we apply that understanding and move on more fully resolved in our goal with God by our side. Let me give you a couple of examples in some of these motivational quotes that I found in putting this together. The one on the right there says, most great people have achieved their greatest success just one step beyond their greatest failure. The person that puts in a little more effort, a little more time, a little more determination. The one on the right says, most so-called failures are only temporary defeats. Will we let it define us? Will we let it make us quit? Let's go to Hebrews 11 and consider this chapter as we consider this topic we're covering today of success and failure. This is a very interesting chapter to look at. It's not an exhaustive list of names of figures and characters, if you will, from the Old Testament that we could learn from. But God here is having Paul record some of their lives to show us what they went through and what they achieved in him. He begins out talking about Abel and Enoch and Noah. These individuals lived in a time period, a very dark time period of mankind's history, as it summarizes it in Genesis 6, that man's thought was only evil continually. He goes on to talk about Abraham and what he went through and what he saw. And in verse 23, he gets to Moses, and it says, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden by his parents. His parents didn't want him put to death, as so many of those other young boys were being put to death. He was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's commands. They had a vision that God would do something with their son. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He walked away from everything, literally. He was probably third in line for the rulership of Egypt. He probably had anything he wanted in terms of physical things, of food, of wine, of anything else. And yet he looked at that and realized that's not what he wanted. It says in verse 25, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And look at the mark that he made. People know who Moses is, even people that aren't Christian. How many people could name a Pharaoh? Any Pharaoh. Verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. He was looking for the same thing that you and I see. To be in God's family, to be eternally spirit as God is, to have the mind of Christ, to be part of what God is doing moving forward. Verse 32, then he moves to the example of many others. Some of these more well known than others. Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets. I'd like to focus on Samson there. Look at what Samson went through. God called him for a purpose, and Samson didn't always see that purpose, did he? How many failures did he have? He didn't listen to his parents and the wife that they chose for him. Didn't listen to others that tried to direct him. Didn't listen to God at times, especially towards the end of his life. He became arrogant and believed that he was the reason he was what he was. And so he loved a woman so much that he compromised what God told him to do. She cut his hair. He was without strength. They blinded him and they put him in fetters, using him as a beast of burden. How much time do you think he had to think about all that? And he could have given up. He could have just withered and died. But he realized he needed to finish strong. And so as his strength came back, he asked God to deliver him one more time to allow him to do what God wanted him to do. And as he brought down that temple, it says that there were more Philistines killed in that one moment than all that he had done in his life previous to that. This chapter, I said, is very interesting. What if God is going to expand this type of list in the future? Would your name be on it? What achievements would God point to as an example to others? Maybe some of our successes, maybe some of our failures. Let me give you just a couple of more of those motivational quotes. The top one there is Winston Churchill. He says, "Success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. The vision never changes, no matter what happens between here and there." The other one, again, is from Napoleon Hill, and he says, "Effort, we lost the connection." I don't have it in my notes, so I can't read it to you. We'll let Mr. Warner fix that. Let's go to Romans 8 next. Romans 8, verse 31. I mentioned earlier that our success as a Christian, fortunately, is not dependent solely upon us. We do have to put our effort in. We do have to do our part. We do have to rise to the challenges and overcome them. But in Romans 8, verse 31, we're reminded of something here as well. And it says, "What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" In the calling that God has given us, He is not looking for reasons to fail us. He is not looking for us to fail at all. He is looking for us to succeed. To go back to this quote, it says, "Effort only fully realizes its reward after a person refuses to quit." God is looking for us to succeed. If God is for us, who can be against us? Is that real in your life? That the goal that's in front of us is obtainable. That it's there when we put in the effort, rise to these challenges, overcome, and when we have God with us. Jeremiah 29, let's conclude there in Scripture. Jeremiah 29, verse 11. Someone gave this to me a few years ago on a little plaque that I have on my bookshelf in my office. So I'm reminded of this quote on a regular basis, Jeremiah 29, verse 11, where Jeremiah records for us, "For I know the thoughts that I think." This is God speaking. He says, "I know the thoughts I have." Those are not thoughts of you failing. Those are not thoughts of you not being able to succeed. He says, "I know those thoughts," he says, "thoughts of peace and not evil, to give you a future and a hope." God says, "These are the thoughts I have. The thoughts I have are for you to succeed and be a part of my family, to be like my son, to live eternally with us." And so we need to keep the faith. so that there can be success in what others would deem failure or even foolishness. We need to remember that God is with us in this great calling to eternal life, and that we can become a member of His spiritual family. We need to remember that we can succeed, but we need to never give up. Success as a child of God, no matter what the failures might look like, is achievable. May you always succeed in your calling.